Welcome to the third edition of the CAME Health Professions Education Podcast. I'm Robert Sternsis, a member at large on the Executive Board of Directors of CAME. This podcast is designed to help clinical teachers apply scholarship in health sciences education to their teaching and is part of several CAME offerings intended to promote health sciences education research, scholarship, and best practices at a national level. For more information about CAME or to become a member, visit www.came-acem.ca. Today, we are extremely fortunate to have Dr. Kanine Osei-Tutu as our guest. For those of you not familiar with Dr. Osei-Tutu's work, he is a hospitalist and associate professor in the Department of Family Medicine at the Cummings School of Medicine in Calgary. He was recently appointed as Senior Associate Dean, Health Equity and Systems Transformation. Having previously worked as Director of Resident Support for Postgraduate Medical Education and as Associate Director of Student Advocacy and Wellness for Undergraduate Medical Education. Dr. Osei-Tutu's scholarly work focuses on anti-racism in medicine and medical education, with recent publications in the CMEJ and CMAJ, which will serve as the basis for this episode. Kanine, welcome to the podcast, and thank you for taking the time to share some of your insights of your work with us today.
Thank you, Rob. It's an honor and a pleasure to be here.
So let's dive right in. I'm going to start with a not so easy question, as I tend to do. So in the space that you work in, there is often a lot of confusion about the use of various terms like equity, diversity, inclusion, anti-racism, or cultural safety. Can you help our listeners understand what anti-racism is and highlight how its embedding into how we think about health sciences education is both different and related to EDI and cultural safety?
Well, thanks for that question. And I think it's a great one and a great place to start. And I think it's also important that your audience is aware that for me, this discussion is framed and should always be framed in the larger context of shared humanity. The work in which I'm engaged in anti-racism isn't work that I chose. It's work that chose me. And I'm doing this work to influence what I can in my sphere of influence so that my children, who are really nice kids, you'll meet them one day, don't have to go through some of the experiences that I know my colleagues have gone through, that current trainees are going through. And when we have these conversations, I think it's really important that the audience understand that we're talking about shared humanity. We're talking about seeing one another for who we are. And when we're falling short of that goal, then how do we find strategies to get us closer to that ideal of being able to actually really be together and see one another and care for each other and be compassionate? And so anti-racism for me, and I think as you highlighted, definitions really matter, words really matter. And it wasn't until I came across an actual definition for anti-racism that resonated with me, that actually allowed me and allows me to engage in this space with you today, because prior to that, I didn't have a way to navigate the world in an effective way without the tools. And so I hope this definition that I'm about to recite will be instructive to your learners. I cite it in my papers, but anti-racism, fundamentally, people need to understand is that it's first and foremost a stance. It's a disposition, it's an orientation that you or one takes to the world. It is a process, meaning it's an ongoing process of unlearning, relearning, and discovery. It's a systematic method of analysis. So in way in which you look at the world, a particular lens that you put on when you're looking at a policy, a procedure, a practice, a person. And it's a proactive course of action. So critical to the anti-racism frameworks is action. It's not being a passive bystander. It's not saying that you're not racist. If you read the work of Kendi, he's very clear that there's no safe space of being non-racist. You're either anti-racist or you're something else. And the critical thing about anti-racism is that it actively seeks to identify remove, prevent, and mitigate racial inequitable outcomes and power imbalances between groups and change the structures that sustain the inequities. And it's really that last framing that was really powerful to me when I looked at how I can be effective in trying to shift culture in my sphere of influence. Am I working to identify racist issues? Am I looking to remove them? Are my efforts aimed at preventing them? Am I trying to mitigate those inequitable outcomes? And am I looking to change the structures? And so what's fundamentally different between an anti-racist approach and the language of equity, diversity, inclusion is that equity, diversity, inclusion are outcomes, but they don't describe how one is actually getting there. And people can be talking about equity, diversity, and inclusion. And I've been in rooms and in meetings and committees for months upon months where we're talking about equity, diversity, inclusion, but we haven't actually even had the conversation about racism, which is not the entire conversation, but it needs to be part of the conversation. And EDI as a framework has worked in some respects to advance the interests of women, and we have more work to go, more work to do. We've made some progress in pay equity, but if you look at who is progressing in the EDI movement, you will notice that the women are white women predominantly, and you'll notice that they are not black or brown women. And so if EDI was effective in lifting the voices of all women and closing gender gaps and equity gaps and leadership gaps, then we shouldn't still see that black women get paid less than white women, that black women are not in leadership positions where white women are. The same goes for brown women, other racialized women. And so I think the language of anti-racism is very powerful because it understands what you're actually trying to do, provides you with a strategy. It also allows those who would otherwise tend towards being performative. You can't be performative. If you embrace this definition of what anti-racism is, it's empowering. It also comes with an accountability because you have to be action-oriented and you can't just talk about EDI without actually taking any action. And so I think that's a really important distinction as a framework that has empowered me to be able to engage in the space with some effectiveness.
I think that's a really incredibly helpful definition, and that notion of action, both in terms of acting towards outcomes, but sort of also an active way of looking at the world, is, I think, a really helpful framing for me. And it's interesting because I think about my own upbringing, and for those who don't know me, who are listening, I am a white male. Growing up, I think my family took a tremendous amount of pride in this notion of, modeling and teaching us to be. And I remember my parents using the words colorblind, right? Like we don't notice, or we don't see, we're all the same. And while I think the message was extremely well-intended, I think here that actually, that notion of I'm colorblind as a way of suggesting not racist actually promotes a tremendous amount of inaction because it enables you to not see the plight, the struggles, the differences that are real and that are prevalent and need to be addressed. And so it's tremendously powerful for me actually to start thinking about it in that way. And I still think we hear lots of people, when you talk about anti-racism, refer to this notion of being colorblind. Yeah. And I think it's important that we problematize that. And I think your definition really helps us do that.
Thank you. And I agree that that language of sameness, while comfortable, has not and does not lead to actual progress and change. So it's been able to recognize and celebrate those differences and appreciate them, but honor people's unique heritage, experience, worldviews, and find what's common, but not negate a difference that is oppressive mm-hmm. or used to oppress.
And, you know, certainly the papers that I alluded to at the top in the CMAJ and the CMAJ were definitely calls to action, which align very much with your definition. And starting with the paper in the CMAJ, you know, one of the concluding or one of the later sentences in the paper is you write, it is time for all physicians in Canada to reckon with the uncomfortable truth that racism is the foundational underpinning of our profession, which I think is an incredibly powerful statement, one that I think many within the profession struggle to wrestle with. And so to try to concretize that for us, taking, you know, the education framework that's a la mode in Canada at the moment, which is CanMeds, can you describe to the listeners how one could view that as a racist framework? And what it would take to reimagine it using an anti-racist lens.
First, to wrestle with the statement about racism being foundational and a foundational underpinning of our profession, that's a very difficult hurdle for people to cross. And so we have to look at history and we have to reflect on the origins of our profession. And we have to understand history that's been hidden from us, that we weren't taught in medical school, that we're not taught today, but that has implications to our practice. When I began reading about the origins of medicine in the United States, for example, and how the industry of and the profession of being a physician arose out of experimentation on enslaved African people. And not that this was just an anomaly, and not that it was one or two or five physicians, but that the profession itself, the knowledge that was gained, the procedures, if you want to call them procedures, the horrific things that Black bodies were subjected to, that white physicians used to learn their craft on enslaved women and men, whom many held in their profession. Many physicians in the southern United States were slave owners. Physicians and slave owners had a economic dependency on one another. The role of physicians in the southern United States in the 1800s was to go around and do physical exams, in quotations, to determine which slaves were sound or fit, which were the better slaves for experimentation, for the labor that they wanted them to do. And out of all of that, you know, many, many things arose. Physicians at that time taught and believed that Black people did not feel pain, which justified them performing horrific surgical procedures such as vaginal fistula creations on enslaved women without providing anesthesia when it was available. Once they perfected their craft, and we hear about Marion Sims, it was once he perfected his craft, having done multiple horrific lacerations to Black women's vaginas, once he was satisfied that he could do this repair, he then went and performed this on white women and used anesthesia. These are just some examples, you know, and that's south of the border. Then we look at, in Canada, we look at William Osler, someone that we uphold as a hero in medicine. And if you look at the things he said about Indigenous people and Black people, and there's some, you know, some literature out there that can cite, he specifically talked about not having Black, brown, and yellow people in Canada, that it couldn't happen, that we shouldn't happen. He described Indigenous people as people that had not yet advanced on the upward march of the race. I mean, these were things that were clearly racist notions. When we banned Black medical students from Queens in 1918, these weren't anomalies. And so these are some examples of what we have been, the profession we practice in was based upon. Now, how does that translate into today, and what, how does that impact now as physicians? Well, why is it that a Black 11-year-old boy who shows up at the children's hospital with lower, you know, right lower quadrant abdominal pain could be left to sit in the emergency room? Nurses look at him, think he's stoic, in quotations, probably doesn't need much in the way of pain medication, or if he does, must be drug seeking. Why is it that that 11-year-old boy would have a ruptured appendix, whereas the 11-year-old white boy would be, get an ultrasound, get some analgesia, get taken to the OR? So do we still harbor these notions from that time period? And when you start to connect the dots and see how what we're calling implicit biases, where do they come from? They come as much from what we learned about in medical school. They come as much from what we learned and as much from what we didn't learn. Why do we have race correction? Why did they believe that Black people had different sized lungs than non-Black people? How does that then translate into what we do or don't do at the point of care? So racist care in our current context comes from as much as what we actually inflict upon patients, and we can see that we maybe don't do that as much as was clearly done back in the day, but it's that absence of care. So you don't offer treatment to this person because of their race. You don't offer analgesia to that person because of their race. You don't give them the same tests or investigations as you would by someone else if they weren't Black or Indigenous. And we know this is happening. We know it's happening in our profession. We know that Indigenous people are waiting longer in the emergency department, that they're dying because of racism. We know the same is happening for Black people. And we have to ask ourselves why. Why is that happening? Why did it happen back then? Why does it continue to happen? And if, unless our profession is completely immune from the rest of the world, which does have elements of oppression and racism and other forms of discrimination, in addition to a lot of really great things, medicine has good and bad in it. And we need to have a greater inclination to what's good. And part of that comes with recognizing some of the foundation of our profession, and that it is relevant and playing out today in the care that we provide or the care that we don't provide. And whether it's implicit or explicit, it doesn't matter. If as a physician we are agents of harm because of our ignorance, that's not acceptable.
So I think what I'm hearing, and that was an incredibly rich answer that I'm going to try to summarize in just a sentence, is that when we think about our structures and our systems, both in medicine and in medical education, and given that this is an education podcast, let's use CanMeds as the example. Mm-hmm. It's not that the notions of a physician being a communicator or a collaborator or a health advocate, that those concepts are inherently racist. It's that because the framework was built within a structure with a racist foundation and was built without explicit attention to anti-racism, it cannot be considered not racist.
That's correct.
And Am I capturing that well?
Yes, I would take it a step further, and I would say that if you accept that the behaviors I described about what physicians did to enslaved Africans, or what some physicians currently do in terms of not giving care to patients because of their race, if you accept that that is racist behavior, explicitly anti-racist, that behavior persists, perpetuates, and increases, the way society has been structured, the natural inclination is not to be anti-racist. If we exist in a state of neutrality and think we're benign, then it's these systems and structures that we're just supporting and reinforcing without being aware of it in many cases. And so if when we take a framework like CanMeds that is constructed with the best intentions, what lens was that framework constructed through? What voices were considered? What voices were not considered? And so by not being intentional in thinking about that, then you create a system that creates harm, perpetuates inequities, perpetuates racism and other forms of oppression. Not because the people that constructed it were intending to do so, but if they weren't intentional not to do so, then you create and reinforce the system in that way.
I think that's incredibly helpful. And I think it allows for the conversation to move beyond where I find people normally get stuck, which is how can one say that being collaborative is racist? And I think that you're providing a way to shift in that conversation into what we're really talking about, which is the lens to which we understand what it means to be collaborative.
Yes.
And explicitly and actively coming back to this action, re-looking at those things with that new lens.
Yes.
So I think that's really helpful. And I wonder now, shifting gears a little bit, kind of coming back to the beginning of this discussion where you really eloquently sort of foregrounded that all of this work really derives from, you know, shared humanity and common humanity. There are some, and I know you've heard this before in different spaces, that would say that focusing on anti-racism as we reimagine educational structures, curricula, really serves to exclude other marginalized or oppressed groups. How do you respond to those concerns? How do you help people understand that that's not, in fact, what's happening?
It's a great question, and it is one that takes, on the one hand, quite a bit of thought to answer, and then on the other hand, it doesn't take much thought at all. And just to unpack that dichotomy a bit, when someone is suggesting that talking about anti-racism is exclusive or divisive, the question that I would ask is, why do you say that? What on what basis are you making that statement? Because their answer will then reveal what lens they are coming from. To unpack that a bit more, when I'm talking about anti-racism and I'm talking about systemic barriers and folks that are structurally marginalized, in these communities of Black, Brown, Yellow, racialized people, there are LGBTQ plus individuals, there are people with varying abilities, visible and invisible, there are people with different sexual orientations, there are all spectrum of identity recognized in these other populations that happen not to be white. So if someone says to me, talking about anti-racism is exclusive, what lens are they looking through? Because if they only see LGBTQ people as white people, if they only see people as disabilities or varying different abilities being white people, if they only see women as being white people, then I guess in their mind, that conversation perhaps doesn't include them. But if they saw beyond the race, which is where I come back to my opening comments about shared humanity, people that are looking through this lens of white privilege or white supremacy have a hard time looking at a group of Black people, for example, and seeing them as folks that would have varying abilities, varying social identities, varying degrees of ableism, gender, various gender spectrum. They just see the race and they ignore the intersectionalities. And when I'm talking about anti-racism, I'm talking about anti-racism through an intersectional lens, because I know, and we should all know, that we all have varying identities and belong to many different social categories if we're allowed. The issue in this society is that when you're racialized as a certain way, you're racialized as Black, you're racialized as Indigenous, you're racialized as a person of color. The white supremacist structure, and I'm going to stay focused on the structures, are set up such that is the division, because it doesn't allow people the opportunity to really see people as people, if you know what I'm saying. So that notion of anti-racism being exclusive can only be exclusive if someone is looking at the conversation through a lens that is extremely narrow and doesn't recognize or value or appreciate the intersectional identities of the people that are having the conversation.
That intersectionality piece is, I think, really helpful and interesting. And as I reflect back and almost feel like you're kind of weaving a tapestry here for me in my own understanding of all of this, you know, one might come back and say, well, when we're talking about EDI or, the rights of the LGBTQ community, that, you know, there are Black people within that community, and so they're included too.
Yes.
But as we said right at the outset, EDI has done really great things for women, but not for Black women, or not for women of color. And so it becomes this idea that as we focus in on some of these other intersections, somehow race always gets ignored. Mm-hmm. And that really, you know, illuminates to me the need and the empower and the importance of actually centering it in the way in which you talk about.
Mm-hmm. Yes, I agree, because if we don't, the natural tendency in the anatomy of these conversations, if you have them, always goes to people wanting to talk about anything but race. You know, if you start a conversation about racism, maybe you can stay engage in that conversation for a few seconds before they want to switch to, what about this? What about that? What about another group, or another issue or concept? Because it is so fundamental, and it is where people's views truly get exposed, and whether they recognize it or not. And then sometimes when they recognize it, I think that becomes even more uncomfortable and people want to move further away from that. And so it's really, I would love to be talking about other things. You know, I would love to be talking about leadership development, continuing professional medical education, professional identity formation. There's many other topics that are part of who I am, compassion, inclusive compassion, that are all things that I would love us to be talking about, but we have to have this conversation now. We have to draw a line in the sand to say, now at this point in time in medical education, in the medical community, we have to have this conversation. We have to really have it deeply acknowledge the past and the present so that we can break through and have a conversation about what the future is to look like. Because it's our system of medical education is not working for everyone. It's not working for the people that need the care the most. It's not working for the physicians that have these other identities and come from structurally marginalized groups in the same way that it's working for other physicians. And so we have an opportunity to get closer to what the profession could be, to reimagine it in a way that, if not for those foundations, when people that weren't white were not considered human, that's the fundamental issue. People that were not white, and this isn't a conjecture, there's laws and there's documents and there's everything just followed from that. The policies, the procedures, the practices. If I'm not human, not considered human, it's very difficult for someone that considers themselves a human to treat me as a human.
I have to say, I feel incredibly privileged to be in this conversation with you. And I certainly hope and I feel that our listeners are going to stay engaged in this conversation, no matter how uncomfortable it may be. And so I will thank you again at the end, but just as I'm sitting here reflecting on how fortunate I feel to be engaging in this with you, I couldn't help but share that. I'm going to move us along to sort of the last segment or the last topic, which really kind of gets us into the weeds of what this looks like, what anti-racism looks like in education. And in the CMEJ paper, which really focused on looking at anti-racist competencies for the new upcoming CanMeds 2025 framework, there are many competencies that were proposed that talk about demonstrating anti-racist practices. And I'm wondering if you can provide some examples, one or two examples, of what an anti-racist practice looks like in the clinical environment.
Okay. That's a great question. And I think I want to go in the weeds and a bit out of the weeds as well. I think fundamentally, an example that I hope learners and physicians could relate to is the notion of being an upstander. And this goes back to the way in which a physician sees themselves. And it goes back to this idea of our fundamental orientation, because our medical training has been the physician is that objective, neutral observer that makes decisions based on, you know, information that he or she or they sees in front of them. But there's limits to what they do because of this notion of their physicianhood. If a learner is in an environment or a physician is in an environment and they see, for example, or hear their patient being called racist names, being denied care or left to sit in the waiting room because of their race, or they may wonder if it's because of their race. Anti-racism in practice, if you see yourself as an anti-racist and you incorporate that as part of your physician identity, means that you need to intervene. You need to act in that situation. So if it is a nurse or a colleague or another patient that's saying something racist to someone in your care, the skills involved are standing up and calling that behavior and letting that individual know that it's not acceptable, as an example. That is the minimum bar, right? That is the low hanging fruit, but it's the thing that people will feel the most uncomfortable doing. Oh, I don't feel comfortable. I don't know what the words are. I'm not sure what to say. I don't want to make that patient feel bad. I don't want to make that colleague feel bad. And by that inaction, that physician or learner is perpetuating racism, is allowing harm to come to their patient, is not honoring their duty of care, and in fact is an agent of racism in that setting. And so at a very basic level, it is the orientation, it is the way we see ourselves as physicians to understand that in these settings, being anti-racist is and has to become a core value, a core part of our identity, a core part of what we stand for, because otherwise we are participating in harms. We are the drivers in the system of the inequities we see by saying nothing and doing nothing and allowing things to happen and thinking of the comfort of the perpetrator rather than of the patient whom we're there to care for, or of our colleague, if it's the colleague that experiences that treatment as well. And so it comes back to how we see one another, how we relate with one another, and what we see our responsibilities to one another and to our patients. Physicians of today need to understand that if you are not being actively anti-racist, you're perpetuating racism. You're an agent of racist behavior and other harms. You know, and again, there's intersections of identity. If that patient is racialized and from a low socioeconomic status and has other, you know, issues or barriers or access to care, what are you doing about it? Like, what are you doing to intervene in that person's care? What are you doing to prevent them from having further harm? Why are you allowing that colleague of yours to make a disparaging comment, or that nurse not to offer them the same analgesia they'd offer a patient that wasn't racialized? If you notice these things, you have to stand up and speak up. And at a basic fundamental level of competency, that is where, at a minimum, we need to be.
I think that is, and I thank you for kind of taking us into the weeds a little bit, because that's a really concrete example. And as I'm listening to it, as I'm thinking and nodding along, going, yes, like this is what the physicians of tomorrow need to be learning and need to have within their identity. And this is what education needs to aspire to. Mm-hmm. I then find myself thinking back to the clinical teachers who were not trained with that worldview, who are now, if this is ever going to produce meaningful change, going to need to be able to role model it, notice it, assess it, which is a monumental task for the average clinical teacher out there in whatever teaching hospital. So what advice would you have for them to how they can contribute to the acquisition of these competencies in the physicians of tomorrow?
They need to start reading. They need to educate themselves. They need to embrace the notion that continuing professional development does include learning about anti-racism, anti-oppression, intersectionalities, equity, diversity, inclusion, trauma-informed care, cultural safety, upstander intervention, critical consciousness. That while this language may seem out of place in medicine, it is fundamental with respect to humanity and how we treat each other. People have had 400 years of knowledge to draw on about racism in society. It's not too much to ask people to seize the opportunity to make a difference and see themselves as having a moral obligation to participate in making that difference. And it's not the only difference to make. We have to do things in planetary health. We have to do things in climate change. We have to do things in a lot of other areas. And this is one of them too. And this is a public health emergency. And this is a public health crisis. And as physicians, we're supposed to be making health better, you know, for all. If the will is there to learn, then the resources will follow, right? If the policies and the standards are set, then the faculty development will follow. And it's not that hard. It's really basic. It's really treating someone the way you'd want to be treated. And if that takes a monumental shift in consciousness, then we're a lot far off than where we may think we are. I choose to believe that we're much closer to getting there. I think it just requires drawing a line in the sand. And so with, for example, this CanMeds project, which has the opportunity to be extremely influential, we just have to have the courage to say, this is fundamental, this is foundational, this is settled law, this is the way it has to be, and these other things are important too, but so is this.
I think that optimism is really encouraging, is really motivating, because it can sometimes feel like a mountain to climb. And hearing you express it in that way, I think is incredibly helpful. And there is no doubt that you have made a difference, that you've made a difference with your papers. You've made a difference with the work you're doing with the Royal College. And certainly just for myself and having had the opportunity to engage in this discussion today and some other discussions with you in different contexts, I understand and see things in a way that I did not before. And it has definitely impacted the way I do things, the way I am in the clinical environment and outside the clinical environment. And I think you're right. I think it doesn't take a whole lot to have your eyes open. You just have to have the will to do that. And I thank you for helping me do that personally. And I really think through this podcast, you're going to have helped a whole bunch of other clinical teachers begin to open their eyes around these issues. So, Kaneen, thank you so much for joining us for the podcast today.
Thank you. Thank you for the opportunity, Rob. And it's been wonderful having this conversation with you. It's given me a lot to think about as well. And I'm on a journey too, and I'm learning every day and trying to find new ways to bridge gaps and find ways that we can advance this conversation. And so I'm really grateful to have this space. I do want to mention one last thing as we close. And I think it's important that for people who are struggling with what to see or how to see or how they should be looking at things, I would encourage people to reflect on this moment of time when the world stopped, when we were inside our homes, and where if we chose to watch, we would have watched a man get executed in broad daylight, being suffocated for 9 minutes and 29 seconds. And I would encourage your listeners to sit down and watch if they haven't. Not just a few seconds or a minute and 30 seconds or five. Watch the 9 minutes and 29 seconds. And then think about shared humanity and what we can do to make that a reality.
think those are incredibly wise words to end on. So thank you again for this conversation. And to all of our listeners, I sincerely hope you've enjoyed this discussion as much as I have, and that you'll consider joining us for upcoming CAME activities, including more of these podcasts as well as webinar series. And as a reminder, again, if you'd like more information about all of the educational offerings that CAME has, or to become a member to benefit from our content and funding opportunities, don't forget to check out www.came-acem.ca. Thanks for listening, and Kaneen, thanks again for being here.
Thanks, Rob. This has been great.